I am Plata on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. I recently talked to Renee Sarojini Saklekar about the book she's co-written with Dr. Mark Winston, who joins me now. The book is called Listening to the Bees, and in it you'll read Renee's poetry and notes on Mark's research from a distinguished career as one of the foremost researchers and academics on bees and pollination. The book is terribly engaging, and it's an urgent book, as the importance of bees can't be understated. I'll get Dr. Winston to reflect on the book and his career, as well as his collaboration with Ms. Saklekar. We'll also talk about what we can learn from bees. Mark L. Winston is the 2015 recipient of the Governor General's Literary Award for Nonfiction for his book Bee Time, Lessons from the Hive. He is a researcher, teacher, and writer. He directed Simon Fraser University's Center for Dialogue for 12 years, where he founded the center's Semester in Dialogue. This book is published by Knightwood Editions. We taped this interview last week. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Mark Winston. Dr. Winston, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
That is my pleasure.
Where were you born?
Where was I born?
Yeah.
I was born in Brooklyn, New York.
I see. Okay. And then, because I'm reading the book, and then you spent some time in Kansas. Is that where you went to school?
Yeah, I was born in Brooklyn, grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. Lived in Massachusetts for many years, then did my PhD at the University of Kansas, and came up to Canada in 1980.
Yeah, no, Lawrence, Kansas, is that, I remember that, because I've always wanted to go to the Eisenhower Presidential Library, and that's near Abilene, isn't it?
It is, not too close to Lawrence.
No,
Lawrence is best known for the Jayhawks, the University of Kansas basketball team.
Is that where Naismith is buried?
Yes.
Yeah. Pardon me for the digressions. It's just, you know, when you think of these things and where stuff is and you know, you make these connections. How did you end up in bee science, if you will?
Well, I started out as an extremely poor student. I got a terrible grade when I was an undergraduate, hated school, but had the good fortune of finding a faculty mentor and worked in her lab for a number of years, publishing papers as an undergraduate. And after that, I went down to Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and worked for other people for a while. You know, every 3 months, every 6 months, I would change jobs doing research assistant things. And I eventually realized I wasn't going to ever run my own shop unless I got more schooling. And Kansas had a reputation for sending students to the tropics to do research, and I had become interested in insects, and so seemed to be a good fit.
Mm-hmm. And I guess bees are your specialty, but I mean, you must have studied other insects and other bugs, if you will.
Oh, yeah, I knew nothing about bees when I went out to Kansas.
Really?
But my supervisor was actually going off on sabbatical, and when I arrived in August, he and I overlapped for 15 minutes. And in that 15 minutes, he told me he had just received a grant to study killer bees in South America. And I heard South America wanted some adventure and said, I'm in.
Yeah.
And ended up a year later in French Guiana, knowing almost nothing about bees and having spent pretty much no time with my head in a honeybee hive. So that was actually a great advantage because I had no preconceptions, and the work we did was pretty different than the kind of research that had been done in the past, partly, I think, because we all came at it without the traditions of studying beekeeping.
And so in your time, because you've been at it for a while now, 40 years or so, how we've looked at bees, has that changed at all?
Oh, dramatically, yeah. I was part of a movement, I would say, in the science world that was focused on bees, and particularly honeybees, that came to be known as behavioral ecology, studying the behavior of organisms in the environments in which they live. And honeybees had never really been studied that way before. And so there was a lot of improved understanding of the natural history of bees and how their behaviors were adapted to different environments. And the other big thing that's changed, and this is probably because honeybees are in so much trouble these days, is an increasing awareness of the other bee species. There's about 20,000 species of bees, and these wild bees are critically important for pollination, critically important ecologically, but we're kind of the poor cousins of the honeybee until recently. And so now I think we have a more balanced perspective about all the bees.
Now, wasps, they're not bees at all, are they?
Not in the least, although bees, many millions of years ago, evolved from wasps.
Mm.
So wasps are the ancestral group for bees, but they are quite different. The biggest difference between them functionally is that bees eat pollen for protein, and so they have very plumose hairs all over their bodies.
Uh-huh.
Whereas wasps, some wasps do eat pollen, but they don't have the same type of hairs. They just have simple straight hairs.
Yeah. Now, I guess bees suffer from the sort of PR reputation of wasps, because everyone hates wasps. And so when you see a bee, as I told Renee recently when I talked to her for this book, the tendency is to swat at them. And I guess if you do encounter a bee, that's not what you should do, right?
Well, you shouldn't swat at a wasp either for a number of reasons. One is you're more likely to get stung
mm-hmm.
if you swat. The second is wasps are very beneficial. They eat a lot of other pest insects,
mm-hmm.
and in that way they help us reduce the use of pesticides. So swatting is both makes it more likely for you to get stung,
mm-hmm.
and it makes you into kind of an ecological bad guy. So
yeah, and I suppose swatting alone, you know, I mean these are the challenges that bees face, and a lot of the challenges I guess are human. Are responsible by humans. Climate change, is that a factor at all?
Climate change is definitely a factor in shifting bee populations. We're seeing a lot of bees going extinct in particular regions and moving into new habitats as climate change progresses. And as the plant communities change, the bee communities change along with them.
Mm.
So it is having fairly profound effects on the composition of species.
And the population of bees, that's gone down. It just hasn't moved away, has it? I mean, it really has gone down because of, as you said a moment ago, the use of pesticides, right?
For a number of reasons, bee populations are in decline, and both managed and wild. Pesticides are certainly one of them. Nutritional problems are another. The large single crop acreages that we have in agriculture are good for bees for a very short period of time, and then because there's nothing else blooming, they're virtual deserts. So that lack of diverse nectar and pollen sources has also been a critical factor in the decline of bees.
I guess the question that you and Renee are getting as you're talking about this book and making appearances in the sort is how do we listen to bees? I mean, is there a way that you've been able to figure out how we can?
The listening to bees is a matter of a search image, I think. I remember a time many years ago, my mother was a bird watcher, and she and I were walking through a forest in Florida once, and I was looking at all the insects and completely ignorant of the birds, and she was looking at the birds completely ignorant of the insects. And it struck me how siloed our perspectives of the natural world are with the search images of particular things that we've developed. And, you know, developing more of a search image for bees and understanding they're there, finding out more about their biology, reading more about them, opens up a very rich world, not only to understand bees, but to understand the ways that organisms depend on the environment around them. And so the listening is there for the having. It just means slowing down and paying a little bit of attention.
They do tell us a lot about ourselves, don't they?
Yeah, when you start listening to bees, it's pretty, you know, I don't think bees are like people. I try not to make the
mm-hmm.
mistake of anthropomorphizing bees. Bees mm-hmm. are bees. But there are a lot of things about bees that we can learn from, and particularly the more social bees like the honeybees, who are paragons of collaboration, communication, cooperation. I think we have a lot to learn about how to live successfully in the communally
mm-hmm.
from bees. So, yeah, there's quite a bit to glean from their lives.
Yeah, their society, the way they've structured themselves. What's key there, and why do you think we don't, say, emulate them as much as we should?
Well, honeybees do a number of things that we would be well-served to emulate. Maybe the largest, biggest one is they listen to each other. There's just constant communication going on in the hive, and bees pay attention and make wise decisions because they listen to each other without any filters. You know, they're not screening out the noise of some of the bees and listening to the others. They just take in all the information and then make good decisions. They also make decisions based on the good of the hive. And I think we would be well served to be making more decisions based on the common good rather than just our individual needs. Bees also tell us a lot about how to work. Bees are not workaholics. Everybody thinks busy is a bee,
yeah.
But bees are not actually that busy. Unless they're really stressed, they spend most of their time resting. And I think, and they also do one thing at a time. They don't, you know, do multiple tasks. They'll do one task at a particular point in their life, and then as they get older, they'll move to doing a different task, which gives them an ability to focus on one thing. It means they get the job done a little bit more efficiently. So I think, you know, communication, collaboration, the societal good, the way we work, these are all things that we can learn from listening to the bees.
As most species do when they as they get older, bees, do they slow down as we do, say?
I'd say they speed up, if anything.
Hmm.
The end of their lives, bees are foragers, and that's a time where they leave the nest and are much more subject to mortality factors. You know, bad weather comes in. It's really, really hard work to fly and to carry nectar and pollen back and forth, so they're wearing their bodies down. There's a lot of predators outside that you don't find inside the hive. So I'd say their end of their life is accelerated, if anything. They're taking all that rest that they do is designed so they can have this very frantic period at the end where they work extraordinarily hard and only they only do that for a few days before they die.
Well, what do bees do for leisure, for pleasure even?
Oh, I don't know if pleasure is a real strong motivator for bees.
Huh.
They certainly rest, but I've never thought that bees were happy or sad. They don't seem to have that range of the particular range of emotions.
Yeah. What the book Bee Time that came out what 3-4 years ago now?
Yeah, 2014.
2014. Yeah. It was a hugely popular book. It received great critical acclaim. Was that around that time that you first met Renee?
It was.
Yeah.
I actually met Renee. I interviewed her for Bee Time. There's a chapter in Bee Time about bees and the arts, and I wanted to have some writing in there about poetry. And I had met Renee through Lunch Poems and discovered that she was a collector of bee poems. And I interviewed her for the book, and there's a page or two in the book about that, which she had to say about bees and poetry. And that was the beginning of the relationship that led to this book.
Yeah, and you guys collaborate and make presentations and the sort, and as I talked to her recently, they're well-received, aren't they?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the reasons we proceeded as far as the book was the readings that we were doing of her poetry and my essays. At that time, my essays from Bee Time and some new poetry she was writing based on my research were powerful. You know, I do a lot of speaking,
mm-hmm.
as does Renee, and I'm pretty clear when an audience is moved. And I could see when Renee and I were doing our readings that the audiences were going pretty deep. You know, they really were paying attention, and it was quite a moving and emotional experience for them and for us. And that, I think, helped propel us to do all the work that a book requires.
Well, it struck me as I'm reading, listening to the bees, whether it's your work or hers in it, is that people have been thinking about bees for a long time, and you see that in the literature, not only it's scientific, obviously, but the cultural literature of say poetry, and myth and the sort. Does that inform? I mean, well, I should ask you, how does that inform, say, the work of the academic that you are?
It primarily doesn't for
uh-huh.
most academics,
right?
And I think that's one of the themes of listening to the bees, is that I had this whole research life, which was a pretty typical research life, and we did a lot of fantastic research and discovered a lot of new things. But I've learned through working with Renee and other artists that there's a whole dimension beneath the research that is very rich and very meaningful and really broadens the understanding of what that research is about. And so the lens of poetry is one of the ways we can, you know, as academics, we can think more deeply, think more broadly, go places where the academic side of what we do doesn't travel, take us to the more emotive outcomes that are really underlying all academia. It's just that we kind of cut it out. So, yeah, I think the poetry that and the interactions I've had with Renee and other artists has been, for me, been really deeply impacting, deeply formative.
And so it's given you a lot to think about, hasn't it? Especially her notes and the sort.
Well, very much. I mean, Renee and I in this book are very, it was very much a call and response kind of process.
Mm.
She might write a poem about the research I'd done. And looking at the poem through that research, I guess looking at the research through her poems, I saw that, I saw the research in really different ways. I began to really appreciate the language and the methodology, but also I began to see layers beneath the actual scientific findings that in some ways were some of the most profound things that that have occurred to me during my career. And that, you know, that was a real gift from Renee's poetry. And I think similarly, sometimes I would write an essay and it would inspire Renee to do a poem.
Mm.
So it was really, it was a very truly collaborative enterprise.
Have you attempted poetry yourself in the course of all of this?
Oddly, no. When we got into this, I really thought I would experiment with poetry.
Yeah.
But I'm an essay writer and Renee's a poet. And there was no point where I was really inspired to write poetry. I deeply respect what she does, and hopefully she respects what I do. And they click together really well. And in work I've done with other artists, I have ventured into, for instance, I did a project with a dancer.
Uh-huh.
And I did do a little bit of choreography in that project. But surprisingly, I have not been moved to write a poem.
Now, her understanding of bees, I mean, it's terribly profound, but she comes at it, as she says, as sort of as a layman, you know, as someone who hasn't studied it for 40 years like you have. What do you think her understanding of bees and how inspired she is, what do you think the rest of us can say learn from her interest in bees?
Well, Renee jumped, you know, really right into it. And she's a very openly curious person.
Uh-huh.
And but she was interested in the sounds and the rhythms of the bees. And she was interested in the what she could riff off of from what she saw from the bees. So in some ways, the bees for her were, yes, intrinsically interesting, but more as a jumping-off point for her to take her poetry. And, you know, that's one way that we can listen to bees is, yes, we look at them, but rather than trying to figure out something about the bees, we take what we see and just explore that through language to see what inspires us to think about ourselves. Part of this journey of Renee's has been to rediscover her Hindu heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And for many reasons, you know, she had not explored that for a while, and she was at a point in her life where the bees opened that door for her. And not something you might have predicted going into the project. In fact, the first poetry that she was writing had nothing at all to do with what ended up in the book. But there seemed to be a moment. Actually, I think it was a pretty specific time when all of a sudden I began seeing these poems that reflected her Hindu heritage.
Mm-hmm.
And the spirituality that was inherent in that. And it was almost like a switch had turned on, giving her permission to go back to that early part of her life. And I think that worked for her because she was open to it.
So what's that like for you then, as someone who's looked at bees in a certain way, and you see how someone else looks at bees? I mean, it must. I'm curious to know what that inspires in you, for example.
Well, first, it's been a way for me to get to know Renee better. And I, you know, really enjoy getting to know people. And so that's been a rich experience. It also, and it's reflected in a fair number of places in the book, it's really caused me, inspired me to go back and think about my early days with bees and what did I, you know, what was happening in my life at those times and how might I understand the life I lived then with the, you know, knowledge and the lens of poetry that Renee is applying. And so I think we both went back and it helped us both to revisit different times in our lives that were quite pivotal for us. And, you know, in doing that, I think it very much enriches the present to understand and value where we came from in the past.
And so when you look back at your career and your life and how bees have been in and out of that, pretty much in, I should imagine. I mean, it has been such a rewarding, rich career, hasn't it?
Yeah, I probably not a day goes by when I don't remember how fortunate I've been to have had the adventures and the exposure to bees and also to people. I think the book is really full of people. It's full of memories, and it's reminded me that bees, as much as I enjoyed them, were also a path into getting to know just an extraordinary group of people over the years who also came to bees for different reasons, and that's been very rich for me.
You also get a sense of how people are, what people are, I suppose, but by their reaction to bees. I mean, I told you a moment ago, a lot of us have the if we see if something comes at us, whether it's a bee or a wasp or a fly even, and the tendency is to swat, you get a sense of their understanding of the world, don't they?
I try not to condemn people too much who are terrified of insects. Many insects do sting or bite, and I can understand where that comes from. My own, you know, one of our daughters is not particularly fond of bees or any insect for that matter.
Uh-huh.
I think it partly depends on what you imprint on when you're young. I've seen people who are, not very comfortable around insects, but they have maybe a different totemic animal or plant that they really bond with. Maybe it's trees or maybe it's dogs or, you know, maybe they really relate to killer whales. I think we all need some animals in our life that we can learn from. And I wouldn't critique anyone for not bonding naturally with bees. Some of my own students, they walk into the apiary on day one, and it was absolutely natural.
Uh-huh.
It's like they had been born there.
Yeah.
And there's others who, you know, after 5, 6, 7 years in my laboratory, never became comfortable around bees.
Mm.
Great students, you know, they did really fine research, but they just never picked up that natural touch. But yet they had other avenues in which they could be present to the natural world around them. And I think that's the important lesson, is not that it has to be bees, but we all need some connection to a species, not our own, I think, to really understand what it is to be a sentient being on this earth.
Yeah, that's the thing that I got out of your book, is that you have to find, whether it's bees or not, you have to find that thing to connect with in the wider world. As you said, animals or trees or other species, not only to find your place in the world, but to really understand yourself, right?
Yeah, we need to treat the rest of the world better, and that's certainly one motivation. But a side benefit of that is the more we pay attention to the world around us, the more we understand who we are.
A couple of other things that I was thinking about as I was reading the book. How often do you get stung today?
I don't do much with bees anymore. I work at the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University, and I actually walked away from bee research about 12 years ago.
But when you were, say, walking down the street or you're in the garden or something like that, I mean, I guess knowing bees as you do, you know how to avoid it, right?
Yeah. I go out with beekeepers, and I'm in apiaries a number of times a year, so I do still get stung. But, when I was pretty active, I'd probably get stung hundreds of times a year.
Yeah.
But now I get stung only a few times a year. But the stinging to me is not a big deal.
Do you keep honey in your house?
Oh, yeah. We have, when I closed my bee lab down, we produced a particular brand of honey we called Heavenly Honey, which easily was the best honey in the world.
Yeah.
And when I closed the lab down, I stockpiled enough so that my family can have enough honey for the rest of our life.
And the other thing that I was wondering is why is a book called Listening to the Bees and rather Listening to Bees? I mean, the in there was something that I was thinking about. Was that deliberate, say?
I'm sure it was deliberate, but I don't think the title Listening to Bees ever came up.
Really?
It always just seemed to be listening to the bees. It gave them a little more definition, I think, or a little more formality.
Yeah, I was thinking about it more, it gives them the sort of importance that I think that they deserve.
I don't think that it came up in our discussions, but if it had, I think I would have stuck with listening to the bees.
Yeah.
We had a subtitle for a while.
Uh-huh.
It was Listening to the Bees, Field Notes and Poems. And that just never stuck, although both Renee and I still think of the book as a set of field notes and poems.
That's what it is, yeah. Yeah, it's also a beautifully designed book, I've noticed.
Yeah, the press did a stunning job with this book, and they I must give the press a lot of credit, but also Renee, who's much pickier about design than I am, and you know she really worked hard with the designer to come up with this quite stunning design. It's nice. I mean, it's a beautiful cover,
uh-huh.
But also the inside of the book is, you know, it just has some nice bee touches. And the other thing that's in the book that really surprised me was we decided to put some photographs in.
Right.
And these were old photographs. They're really a pretty poor quality. And I don't know what they did, but the quality of the photos in the book is actually better than the originals.
Mm.
So I was really pleased. I was really pleased with that.
Yeah, it really is a beautiful book, but it's a marvelous collaboration, and I can't tell you just how much I enjoyed reading it, because it really is a dialogue, it's a conversation that the two of you have in this book. It's been a pleasure to talk to you today. Thanks for this, and again, congratulations and continued good luck with the book, Mark.
Thanks very much.
The book is called Listening to the Bees. It's from Knightwood Editions. It's co-author Dr. Mark Winston. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.